Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa, and today the whole gang are here. That's Heather, Nicola, Stephanie, Linda and Pat.
Hello! Hi.
Today we're discussing the importance of a sense of place in fiction and looking at how we can create one. Heather will be sharing her work in progress with us, and Nicola and Kezia Frost will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. Stephanie is feeling upbeat, but first Linda will ask us to
name the novel.
Yes, I will. Okay, you know I struggle with these clues. Do the rest of you struggle with whether or not it's going to be too hard or too easy?
No. Don't worry about it.
I tried to make the first clue easier than the novel. Okay, name the novel if you can. This 1997 historical novel won the U.S. National Book Award for Fiction. The novel, which was the author's first, sold roughly 3 million copies worldwide. It was adapted into an Academy Award-winning film in 2003. Despite its bestseller status, it received mixed reviews. Several critics felt the narrative was overlong and the pacing too slow. One reviewer said, "There's no doubt that the author can write. The problem is that he stops so often to savor the sheer pleasure of the act of writing."
Okay.
Oh, dear.
Interesting. That doesn't
help me.
No. Well, there's some clues there, but okay. Nothing's leaping out at
me. Not yet. The book shares several similarities with Homer's Odyssey. It tells the story of a wounded deserter from the Confederate Army near the end of the American Civil War, who walks for months to return to the love of his life, Ada, a minister's daughter recently relocated from Charleston to a farm in a rural mountain community for which the book is named.
Well, I guess
I might have seen the film.
If you know it, you'll have got it from that. There's a lot of clues there.
Yeah, I thought I'd been pretty well with all that.
I don't know it.
So, no. I think I've seen the film, but I can't remember.
Number three. The movie starred Nicole Kidman.
Don't they all?
Renee Zellweger and Jude Law, who portrayed the soldier W.P. Inman, and won the Oscar for Best Actor. Zellweger received an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress.
I can see Renee Zellweger on a porch looking really ugly. And I've seen a clip from the film, and that's all I know.
No, I
can't just remember.
Really? Might be a different film.
You got us.
Oh, but I think the clues were fair.
I'm sure they were.
It's Cold Mountain by Charles Frazier.
Oh, I've definitely seen the film.
Well done, Linda.
Yeah, Fraser said, though, that the real W.P. Inman, the soldier, was his great-grand-uncle who lived near the real Cold Mountain in North Carolina. He also said he used John Hadley's book, 7 Months a Prisoner, as inspiration for the novel. I found that interesting that here's somebody who says, I use this book to inspire that. Okay.
Interesting. Very good. Thank you, Linda. Now it's over to Heather for an excerpt from one of her longer short stories.
Part of this comes from an exercise we did in our Write Club, where we had to write about a place. Which I think we're going to be talking about later on today. Mo got a job at a hospital in the centre of Delhi, and we married quietly and quickly, looking forward to the birth of our baby. The political situation in India at the time was very difficult, and although I didn't understand what was going on, I knew that the situation was dire. The British were pulling out of India, and there was talk of establishing new territories and segregating Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs. I should have tried harder to understand what was going on. On the 14th of August 1947, I went into labour, and in the early hours of the 15th, my 20th birthday, I gave birth to a beautiful baby girl. She had masses of dark hair, and I thought she looked just like her father. Mo's mother asked me if she could take the baby and introduce her to the family. I agreed, settled down and tried to rest. I was woken by shouts and screams. I felt the house shake and heard explosions out in the street. I got out of bed and staggered through the now empty rooms and into the street. The noise, dust and detritus of humanity rose to fever pitch. Absolute chaos erupted onto the already overcrowded street. Names were screamed in the darkness. Then the military in their white colonial uniforms bore down on the crowds. The crack of baton on bone mixed with the whimpers of pain. Cries of "Where can we go? Who can help us?" As the crowds dispersed, the magnitude of the violence was catastrophic. Bodies of adults and children were left in the gutter. As I stood in the doorway, I realised I was bleeding heavily and fell to the floor. For a couple of days, I drifted in and out of consciousness before I woke up in hospital bed. The doctors explained that I had to perform a hysterectomy to stop the bleeding and gave me a blood transfusion as I had lost so much blood. I was confused, disorientated, and no one could answer my questions or give me any information about my new baby or Mo and his family. I had no identification, no passport and no money. Mo and my baby had vanished. I was overwhelmed with grief and I felt the world closing in around me. A British official explained to me that my only option was to return to England, as without support I could not stay in India. I was devastated, but I had no other choice. He talked a lot about the chaos of mass migration, but I didn't understand.
That is such a horror story. To lose your baby like that and not know very well.
I like particularly the way we've talked before about changing scenes, and I think you did that very well, where she collapsed in the doorway and then woke up in the hospital.
Yeah.
You know, there was no tricky, long-winded explanations about how she got there. It just moved the story along really nicely.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Mo's mother asked if she could take the baby. I agreed, settled down and tried to rest. It just seemed a bit too casual. I don't know.
I felt the same. I felt that that was, paragraph needed a little bit more.
Yeah, either that she protested and had to be persuaded, or there needed to be like an explanation perhaps, you know, she was so exhausted that she didn't have the...
She would feel some anxiety, but also feel it would be rude not to, or whatever. It's his family. So, I felt that you would have an anxiety about handing over a baby even to a trusted family member.
Yeah.
You'd be thinking, well, what if she needs feeding? And I'd say, well, we'll bring her back or something.
Yeah.
So I agree with that. I think that paragraph needs a bit more emotion, perhaps.
I think perhaps she was at home by the time.
Yeah, that
Mo's mother asked her.
I was unsure about where she was.
But because it's in the same paragraph, it appears that she's still in hospital.
Yeah.
Because the paragraph says you went into labour and gave birth, and then Mo's mother asked me, if that was in a new paragraph and that paragraph wasn't indented, that would actually be a transition to a new time.
Yeah,
because I don't know if she gave birth in a hospital or at home or what.
I can explain, yeah.
It just seems like she gave birth and then
the baby over to her mother-in-law.
Yeah. You know, I'm not saying it's not possible, but that she would have certainly feel anxious about it.
I wondered about the feeding. It bothered me that this, because it seemed to be just born in its infancy and at the house of... Mm-hmm. Mother-in-law going to see to its feeding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're breastfeeding.
I can certainly expand on that.
Okay.
I spotted quite a few repetitions of words, like understand in the first paragraph, and street in the third, bleeding and bleeding and blood in the paragraph that starts about standing in the doorway. But, you know, that's easy to fix. I've just highlighted those for you. I really loved the crack of baton on the I liked that. That was very evocative.
Yes.
When you've got the British official explaining that my only option was to return to England, I was devastated. I think if we could actually see the dialogue, I think that would be more powerful, to have somebody turn up, describe how he's looking nervous. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
The last paragraph is, a British official explained to me that my only option was to return to England, as without support I could not stay in India. I was devastated, but I had no other choice. He talked a lot about the chaos of mass migration, but I didn't understand.
It does go on I've stopped it there, but it does go on.
But I think rather than saying a British official explained, just show us the dialogue and don't even tell us that he explained. Because a dialogue will show, whereas telling us he explained and also you've got the doctor explain that they had to perform a hysterectomy. So there's a lot of people explaining things rather than actually saying them. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you could just leave out the doctor explained in that case.
Yeah.
But I think I like it, it does have a slightly detached tone, but to me that suggests the speaker has told herself this story many times over the years. So I think it's quite effective in a way. She's she's justified it to herself, you know, because if anybody said to you, how did you lose your baby? How come you came home with it? You'd feel you had to justify and explain. So I think that it has that feeling, because of the tone of it, that she's told herself this story many times.
Detachment agree.
This is a sat waiting, because I think we've talked about it before, when trying to go over something and I kind of lost the plot a little bit and lost, you know, exactly how I was going to write that down, so I put it away. Yeah. I only got it back out again to slot that place thing. You know, sort of I needed to go back and look at it.
Well, it's always, I mean, it's never... It's never finished, really, is it? I mean, it's always drafts. And these are only suggestions. You know, you must understand that it's the final choice is yours.
Yes.
These are what we're saying you might choose to do. We're not saying
I've still got comments when you looked at the original piece. I've not incorporated them.
I have a question about the word. I think I've heard others of you use it, disorientated.
I put disoriented.
I did mean to say
disoriented.
I realised when I said it, but I wasn't going to go back and say it. I'd probably say it wrong again. I was wrong.
Disoriented.
It's disorientated. Okay.
I thought I'd heard others use disoriented, and I thought maybe it was.
Well, it is. That's the English.
Disoriented is equally acceptable.
That's the American words.
I didn't know that.
I didn't realize.
I thought American words always had extra syllables in.
No, it's not American.
Anyway, speaking of words, detritus.
Detritus.
The noise, dust, and detritus, or detritus, detritus of humanity. Just didn't seem to fit, because detritus is
rubbish left behind.
It was the word humanity I didn't think was right.
Well, there were two things that I thought about that. One is, can detritus rise to fever pitch?
Well, yes.
But also, detritus of humanity is a phrase, and it's usually used to mean, you know, the people in the lower echelons, or, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm.
So, you know, probably the word detritus. Well, obviously, a few of us.
For me, I thought the word was humanity.
Yeah, well, that's right. Anyway,
as well.
Anyway,
so it's very colourful. It's
very colourful.
Yeah,
there's some really nice writing there.
Yeah,
I like the confusion is coming.
Plot
really
points.
Well.
The plot point is great. How do you lose a baby?
It's wonderful.
That's really powerful.
Masterful beginning, I think, to a story.
Heather. So, Stephanie, how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling happy as Larry, happy as a sandboy, happy as a pig in muck, and happy as a clam.
Oh,
A clam?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
I heard somebody the other day referring to happy as Larry.
That was me.
I thought, why happy as Larry?
Yeah.
Why Larry? So I thought, I'll go and have a look. So, the reason for happy as Larry, well, in 1881, John F. Keane wrote in his book 6 Months in the Hejaz, the boy is now with us in Mecca, happy as Larry, and Larry has a capital L.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1901, in the Sydney Bulletin, there was an expression that said, some of these days a microbe will come sailing over on a piece of music as happy as Larry. And again, Larry is capitalised as a name. Apparently, Australians born before the Second World War often used the phrase happy as Larry when they were very, very happy.
Yeah.
And the etymology of this expression is presumed to have arisen from the success of an Australian prize fighter who was called Lawrence, known as Larry, Lawrence Foley. And he's reputed never to have lost a bout and won several purses, which were a few hundred pounds in those days, but in today's money, it'd be worth much more than £100,000, you know, £120,000, £150,000. So he rose from very humble beginnings to become a wealthy man. and very well known. So that's the theory, that happy as Larry means you're happy as Larry Foley, because you've got some money for not too much work.
It's spread around the world from Australia.
From Australia, yeah. Now, happy as a Sandboy. This one's a bit closer to home. Apparently, there are two main reasons why a Sandboy should be happy. So, publicans and innkeepers in the UK used to spread sand on the floors to catch the slops and the spills.
Mm-hmm.
And in Bristol, in the UK, there's a very long-established pub called the Ostrich Inn, and it's right next to the Redcliffe Caves, which used to be a source of sand. And small boys would be sent into the caves to collect the sand and were then rewarded with a free jug of ale. Which kept them very merry. So they'd be very happy. And then the sand spreading practice was widespread, again, a lot of the delivery people, the delivery boys all over the country would have been kept merry with a payment in ale, because it was hot, thirsty work.
Yeah.
So when the sand was swept up, ready to be replaced with clean sand, the boys who did the sweeping often found loose change among the detritus. So it was another reason for them to smile and be happy.
Uh-huh.
So that's where happy. That's really,
I like that.
That's happy as a Sandboy. It's a lovely old expression.
All these drunk children.
Now, happy as a pig in muck. I mean, sure, we've heard other variations: a pig in clover, a pig in a puddle, a pig in mud, a pig in muck, a pig in the proverbial.
Mm-hmm. I've always said that. Oh, happy as a pig in mud.
Yeah.
Or happy as a clam.
Yeah. If you've ever owned a pig, you'll know what makes them happy.
Yeah.
And all you need to do is watch a pig rolling in just about anything and you'll hear them grunt with pleasure.
Yeah.
So you just figure out what's giving such delight to the pig and you'll have your own simile.
Right.
Happy as a pig in my back garden or
right.
so on. But that's probably a well understood one. Yeah. But it has been used many times, and as happy as a pig in tends to be used these days as somebody that's happy about something that they really have no right to be happy about, I think, doesn't it? Happy as a pig in, I'm not going to say the word, but you know the word.
Oh, yeah.
Happy as a pig in the proverbial.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like there's a bit of resentment.
Yeah.
Oh, he's happy as a pig in. Okay, and finally, why would a clam be happy? Happy as a clam. You've heard that.
Oh, yes, use it a lot. Happy as a clam.
Is it because of their open... Yes. They look like they're smiling.
Well, it's one theory. One theory is that open clams look like they've got a big smile.
Yeah.
But the derivation is more likely to come from the fuller version of the phrase, which was as happy as a clam at high water.
At high tide.
Yeah. Which originated in the northeastern United States in the early 1800s. Mm-hmm. And in John Russell Bartlett's Dictionary of Americanisms in 1848, it says, as happy as a clam at high water is a very common expression in those parts of the coast of New England where clams are found.
Right.
And high tide, or high water, is the only time clams are free from predators, because they're covered by the water.
Yeah.
So presumably you could use the simile happy as any bivalve mollusk to describe the happiest of times.
Doesn't quite have the same ring.
It doesn't, does it?
I'm
going to
use that one. Happy as a bivalve
mollusk.
I love it.
The other thing I picked up on in that little story was the Dictionary of Americanisms.
Yeah. 1848,
fun was that?
Yeah. I'd look at that one.
I think we need to read that and then come up with obscure Americanisms for
Linda. Linda doesn't understand.
That would be fun, wouldn't it? I'm
going to
look for that book.
Talking about that northeast coast of America, I saw a documentary once which had old fishermen and so on talking, and it was talking about accents and dialects and so on, and they had the most bizarre accents, but you could trace southeast England, Norfolk kind of accents there. Because there was some historical link between the two communities.
Mm.
But really sort of fascinating.
Mm.
You may also be surprised to know that there is a dictionary of Southern culture, or it's more like an encyclopedia of Southern culture, and it's about like 6 inches thick or so.
Wow.
Has it got very big font?
No. Oh, that's nasty. It was given to me by a friend when I was living in Rhode Island for many years, And she gave it to me for Christmas, and she said, I bet you had no idea they had that much culture.
I didn't want to say that.
Oh, but we
do. I thought that would be rude.
No, we do.
Thanks for that, Stephanie. You got us going there. We've been thinking about novels and stories with a great sense of place. Those that transport you and make you feel you know the location, even if you've never been there. It can make you want to visit that place, or in some cases, avoid it. Whether it's Narnia or Newcastle, the Pitcairn Islands or the Palace of Westminster, some writers are just great at immersing you in their created worlds. So, who's got something to share? Something they've read?
I have. I love the book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is set in Savannah, Georgia, USA, by John Berendt. And I always thought it was a work of fiction, and it's not. It's based on truth. In fact, the main character in the book, Jim Williams, that was the name of the man who really was in the book. Mm-hmm. But after reading it, I wanted so much to go to Savannah, and I haven't been yet, but I want to go there eventually. He describes the city as a really beguiling place, laid out in squares under a canopy of Spanish moss dripping from old oak trees, mm-hmm. you know. And his description of Monterey Square, which was the square facing where he lived, an early evening mist had turned the view of Monterey Square into a soft focus stage set with pink azaleas billowing beneath a tattered valance of live oaks and Spanish moss. The pale marble pedestal of the Pulaski Monument glowed hazily in the background. And I just thought, what a beautiful sight that is. And also, if you go there in May, I'm told, the whole city blooms with azaleas. Mm-hmm. But it's humid and it's hot, so therefore it's a very sultry kind of place. I think more than the descriptions of Savannah, which were beautiful, are really intriguing, I think the sense of place for me came from the characters. Instead of the setting of the city, the characters who populated it and the traditions they kept were what, for me, defined this place that I wanted to go to. Mm-hmm. They were very quirky and colorful. They had a society of married women's card club. And they would arrive at this house at the door waiting for it to open and just stand there without ringing the bell or anything until exactly 4 o'clock on the minute when they would open the door and go in because it starts at 4. And then John Odom, he was a wonderful character who was a sweet-talking lawyer, speculator, piano player. He didn't work at any of those other than piano playing. He was so handsome and a wonderful kind of con man. Luther Driggers was an inventor, very reclusive guy who would tie threads to insects like flies, etc., and tie them to his clothing, and they buzz around his head all the time. And he carried with him a little bottle and told everyone that it was a potent poison, powerful enough to kill every man, woman, child in Savannah. So people didn't want to make him unhappy. And they would watch when he comes into the cafe for breakfast. Did he eat or not? Mm-hmm. And if he didn't eat his food, they said, oh, Luther's not eating. Don't drink the water today.
So it's the eccentricities and their characters are also...
Oh, it's funny because I read an article by Lucy Cruikshank who wrote The Road to Rangoon, and she says, to truly transport readers, a setting must be more than a mere backdrop, which is what Linda's saying.
Yes. Yeah.
The most memorable locations are central to the story itself, adding to the reader's understanding of the characters, building the atmosphere and driving the action forward. Their every detail, beguiling or terrifying, is charged with emotion. They're not striking for how they look or smell or sound in isolation, but for how they make their readers feel. And I thought that was a really interesting analysis of setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for example, in The Road to Rangoon, you've got the ramshackle towns of Burma, which the son of the British ambassador, Michael, sees as a sort of exotic playground. Mm. Whereas Thusa, who's another character, an Asian character. Those streets hold painful memories for her of her missing family, so her emotions in those places are very different to his. And by comparison, there's forest, dense forests in the Highlands where Michael feels isolated and afraid, but Thuza is very much at ease because she knows how to thrive in the wilderness, and for her the trees are a place of safety. Mm. So the setting has become a character, mm-hmm. but the relationship between the other characters is different. Very different,
yeah, that's really
in the same setting. And I think, you know, I think that's a really important point, that mm-hmm. we don't, a setting isn't just like a scene that, mm-hmm. you know,
no,
scenery
it's
that we walk past.
Not really neutral either. Right. No. It's interesting. Yeah. I know, Nicola, you had something.
Yeah, well, I remember a winter in Brighton when we were renting a house with no central heating and just a tiny fire, and it was very snowy that year. It must have been the early 80s. Absolutely frozen. And if we were in the house, we always had to sit with duvets around us and things. Yeah. And in that winter, I read all three of the Corfu trilogy books and also The Mage by John Fowles.
The Magus.
Yeah. And both of that was set in Greece. And it just, I'd never been to Greece, and it just had such powerful, evocative descriptions of the place. I went back and I got it on my Kindle and I thought, oh, this could be a dull job, isn't it, looking through for some descriptions. But lo and behold, at the end of the first chapter, I come across a really beautiful passage, I think, which I'd like to just read for you, which really had a powerful impact on me, obviously. So the family's just packed up and are going to Greece because they've heard it's cheap there. This is Gerald Durrell, by the way. And he says, "Thus, by our standards, fully equipped, we left the clammy shores of England. France, rain-washed and sorrowful. Switzerland, like a Christmas cake. Italy, exuberant, noisy and smelly, were past, leaving only confused memories. The tiny ship throbbed away from the heel of Italy, out into the twilight sea, and as we slept in our stuffy cabins, somewhere in that tract of moon-polished water, we passed the invisible dividing line and entered the bright, shiny, looking-glass world of Greece. Slowly, this sense of change seeped down to us, and so at dawn we awoke restless and went on deck. The sea lifted smooth blue muscles of wave as it stirred in the dawn light, and the foam of our wake spread gently behind us like white peacock's tail glinting with bubbles. The sky was pale and stained with yellow on the eastern horizon. Ahead lay a chocolate-brown smudge of land, huddled in mist, with a frill of foam at its base. This was Corfu, and we strained our eyes to make out the exact shapes of the mountains, to discover valleys, peaks, ravines and beaches, but it remained a silhouette. Then suddenly the sun lifted over the horizon, and the sky turned the smooth, enamelled blue of a jay's eye. The endless, meticulous curves of the sea flamed for an instant and then changed to a deep royal purple flecked with green. The mist lifted in quick, lithe ribbons, and before us lay the islands, the mountains as though sleeping beneath a crumpled blanket of brown, the folds stained with the green of olive groves. Along the shore curved beaches as white as tusks, among tottering cities of brilliant gold, red and white rocks. We rounded the northern cape, a smooth shoulder of rust-red cliff carved into a series of giant caves. The dark waves lifted our wake and carried it gently towards them, and then, at their very mouths, it crumpled and hissed thirstily among the rocks. Rounding the cape, we left the mountains, and the island sloped gently down, blurred with the silver and green iridescent of olives, with here and there an admonishing finger of black cypress against the sky. The shallow seas in the bays were butterfly blue, and even above the sounds of the ship's engines, we could hear, faintly ringing from the shore like a chorus of tiny voices, the shrill, triumphant cries of the cicadas." Now, who wouldn't want to go?
Especially if it's a cold winter in the UK.
And the book is absolutely studded with it. And I was really astonished because I remember it as being quite a light-hearted book and, you know, mm-hmm. fun. And
it is quite light-hearted.
It's very well written.
Yes. But the characters inhabit the setting, mm-hmm. which is, you know, what we were talking about earlier on.
Mm-hmm. Right,
from a writing point of view, that island has become another character.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you can make the setting another character.
Right. Funnily enough, my example was from my family, another animal.
A different one, though. Yeah, presumably.
Yeah, just about another chapter later on, I think. But when, Linda, you were talking about the guy with the hat and the bias, and of course that made me think of a character from My Family and Other Animals called the Rose Beetle Man.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Who has the same thing, doesn't he?
He ties into his hat.
And he has all these little rose beetles. And he's just one of the vividly drawn characters that, like Steph was saying, create the setting as much as the actual descriptions. I thought this was the end of the first chapter. It might be the second chapter. We sped down a white road covered in thick layer of silky dust that rose in a boiling cloud behind us. A road lined with prickly pears like a fence of green plate, each cleverly balanced on another's edges and splashed with knobs of scarlet fruit. We passed vineyards where the tiny stunted veins were laced in green leaves, olive groves where the pitted trunks made 100 astonished faces at us out of the gloom of their own shadow, and great clumps of zebra-striped cane that fluttered their leaves like a multitude of green flags. At last we roared to the top of a hill, and Spiro crammed on his brakes and brought the car to a dust-misted halt. "There's you ours," he said, pointing with a great stubby forefinger. "That's the villa with the bathrooms, like you wanted." Mother, who'd kept her eyes firmly shut throughout the drive, now opened them cautiously and looked. Spiro was pointing at a gentle curve of hillside that rose from the glittering sea. The hill and the valleys around it were an eiderdown of olive groves that shone with a fish-like gleam where the breeze touched the leaves. Halfway up the slope, guarded by a group of tall, slim cypress trees, nestled a small strawberry-pink villa, like some exotic fruit lying in the greenery. The cypress trees undulated gently in the breeze as if they were busily painting the sky a still brighter blue for our arrival. Oh. And that particular line, that's one that just digs with you.
I've got one, the opening line of 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He talks about his village. And Macondo was a village of 20 adobe houses built on the bank of a river of clear water that ran along a bed of polished stones, which were white and enormous, like prehistoric eggs. It's just really like, good. You're there. Yeah. Like, just straight into it. Yeah.
It's just beautiful. Detail,
yeah. Mm. Well, I think the prehistoric eggs and the polished stones and the clear water, I think, you know, in a very, very short sentence, you know, we've got a sense of history, of remoteness, you know.
Yeah,
it's lovely.
Very clever.
Mine's a little more light-hearted. on the positive side, I learned how to print from my Kindle.
Oh, clever girl.
An achievement for me. I dreamed, she began, that I was sitting in a wonderfully comfortable armchair. It was the most comfortable chair I've ever sat in. It was as if it was made for me. I felt happy sitting there. She shifted on her wooden cane bottom chair. "You know, Uncle, these chairs are not very comfortable. They're too hard to sit on for long. You should buy some new ones." "But that," he cried, pointing a triumphant finger towards the sky, "is my masterstroke. Over the years, I have given this a lot of thought, a lot of thought." He banged a fist on the rain-spattered table. "Think, consider, my dear, the people who live here, the people who visit my makeshift cafe. They are, by nature, among the laziest people in the world. They're not like other people, not even like other Greeks, and certainly not like other nationalities, Germans, say, or Japanese. Here, they sit for hours and hours over a single cup of coffee, telling you how hard they've been working and how tired they are. When it rains, they don't go to work. Even the children don't go to school if it's raining. To do a job would occupy a German for 10 minutes would take one of these people a day and a half. Now, I want you to imagine what would happen if the chair you're sitting on now were comfortable. You have nothing else to do today. You would settle into your chair and perhaps never leave. I would be bringing you coffee all day long. Later on, you would ask me for blankets and a pillow and sleep where you sit. When George, the bus driver, came to drink his beer, he would sit down, make himself comfortable, and decide not to drive the bus anymore today. Beyond all doubt, Athimos, the plumber, would do the same. There would be no public transport on the island. Our drains would remain forever blocked. So, in a moment of genius, I sought out and installed in my cafe the most uncomfortable chairs I could find. It was not difficult. We Greeks are very good at producing uncomfortable chairs. And you'll find none of these hand-picked chairs has four legs the same length. They throw you slightly off balance, so you never quite relax. Always, within half an hour, your backside is numb. You stand up to relieve it, and whilst you're standing up, you might as well go about your business. It is a carefully thought-out strategy, which has so far never failed me. It's perfect for ousting both bores and drunks alike. It's a strategy so brilliant that I wrote to the government suggesting a national ban on comfortable chairs in any form. Imagine the improvements in productivity. Greek manufacturing would lead the world, but I must be honest, they haven't yet replied. Probably some ambitious politician has stolen my idea and is furthering his career by selling it as his own. There was a short silence. She smiled at him. And who could blame him?
Or his chair's too comfortable.
Well, anybody who's been to Greece has experienced it to learn a chair.
I met a book by Anne Zaraudi. It's the first in her series of Greek detective novels. And it just made me think, when I read it, I just thought, wow, that's just Greece. Yeah. That's just uncomfortable chairs in Greece.
Mm-hmm. What is the name of the book?
It's The Messenger of Athens.
Oh, okay.
Yep. There's a bit from Harry Potter. You remember Diagon Alley in Harry Potter?
Oh, yes, I love that.
And it's kind of a very clever way, I think, of writing to create that kind of sense of excitement and promise. And this passage I liked. There were shops selling robes, shops selling telescopes and strange silver instruments Harry had never seen before. Windows stacked with barrels of bat spleen and eel's eyes, tottering piles of spell books, quills and rolls of parchment, potion bottles, globes of the moon. They bought Harry's school books in a shop called Flourish and Blots, where the shelves were stacked to the ceiling with books as large as paving stones bound in leather, books the size of postage stamps in covers of silk.
Oh, really?
That's a great book.
Yeah. Really, you know, atmospheric. Yeah. And I want to go to that bookshop because I love the sound of a bookshop with such an eclectic mix of books.
And I think they did a very good job of conjuring up Diagon Alley in the film as well. You know, the bustle and the hustle and the weirdness of it all was very well done.
Well, I've just got a short excerpt from The Black House by Peter May, and I've talked about this sense of place in his novels before, but it's a little bit set on the Isle of Lewis. The Krobos Stores was in an old stone barn about half a mile away at the road end. It stood on the corner by the main road. It had two small windows, which never seemed to have anything in them, and a narrow doorway between them that opened into the shop. We could see it in the distance, next to a stone shed with a rust-red corrugated roof. The single-track road was long and straight, without pavements, and delineated by rotting wooden fence posts leaning at angles. The fence made a poor job of keeping the sheep off the road. The tall grasses along the ditch were burned brown and bowed by the wind, and the heather was all but dead. On the slope beyond, houses were strung along the main road like square beads on a string. No trees or bushes to soften their hard edges, just a jumble of fences and the rotting carcasses of dead cars and broken tractors. So there you've got quite a windswept scene of decay and neglect on the Isle of Lewis. And there's lots and lots in that book, and also talking about the customs and things of the place.
When the two of you were reading from Lawrence Durrell's book, What My Family and Other Animals, I was struck with the many, many ways he described colours.
It is very difficult because I wrote something recently describing the sea at Pavlo Petri. And you just think, how do you describe all those facets of blue and green? And it did remind me of the stained glass windows by Matisse, which I've seen in the south of France. And it seems a bit pretentious to put that in because it's not a reference for everybody, but the colours were very Matisse-like. But it is.
I once tried to describe Paul Newman's blue eyes, and it was impossible to do anything. I couldn't think of anything but clear as the blue sky or clear as the deep as the sea. And it's just not. I can't think of that. And his book was that's inspiring to think of being able to describe colors.
Wanted to go to New Orleans because of Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles, which really described New Orleans in incredibly vivid fashion.
I want to go to Savannah. I've read a few things about it's similar to the one that you read out.
Good.
It just sounds like a wonderful place to visit.
Yeah.
And of course there are places you don't want to go, like Benin in Africa, as described in A Darkening Stain by Robert Wilson. And I quoted this a few weeks ago, but it's worth repeating. Val McDermid said, Robert Wilson dissects the dark heart of Africa with an insight and compassion that makes it so sleazily vivid you'd pay money not to go.
Oh my gosh.
I remember that. It's like The Room by Emma Donoghue. Yeah, I mean, the whole story takes place in a room 11 by 11 with a skylight.
Yes.
Oh, you wouldn't want to be there.
No.
I'm not familiar with that book at all.
It's good, isn't it?
Really? Yeah.
I loved it.
Another one to add to the list.
Yes.
So I think we're agreeing that it can either be descriptive passages or it can be characters that set a place so vividly.
Mm. Well, also it's an amalgam of the two, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. And the place becomes a character.
Yeah.
Mm. So as in the Black House there, you feel that there's a kind of slow pace of life.
Right.
Life is harsh. The island is windswept and fairly barren. No trees, only sheep. So that becomes a character in the novel itself, as Steph was saying earlier.
Yes.
Mm. And there's also Daphne Capsali, obviously, her 100 Days of Solitude when she moves to Sifnos. You know, I remember that as being very vividly drawn about where she lives and what it's like to be there in the winter.
So,
It's a nice thing to be able to do, isn't it?
Right. It's a wonderful way to think from henceforward about describing place.
Well, a few weeks ago we did an exercise in Write Club about creating a sense of place.
That was a brilliant exercise.
It was.
Well, I'm going to share it now so that other people can try it if they like it. It originally was from an online Open University course I did a few years ago, but I found it really useful and you might want to try it. So the task is describe the city or location your story takes place in with 100 words. Without mentioning any names or dates. Make it evocative enough that others can guess where your novel takes place. So we did this, didn't we? And it was quite useful. Mm. I think, Heather, your work in progress that you read today benefited from that.
And I described an environment which smelt of brute and sweat and had wooden floors, and you all guessed it was the school disco from the 1970s.
Yeah.
It was a really useful exercise not to tell anybody where you were, so you really had to rely on your descriptive powers.
Did anybody bring what they did with them to read?
Oh, I just found mine.
You found yours, go for
it. Yeah, which was actually came from that exercise, but also was from a thing I did in a poetry course where they asked you to look at a great master, a painting, and describe it. In my first attempt at descriptive prose. She stood on the hill at dawn, looking down at the great river flowing to the sea. The mule stamped rosemary underfoot, impatient for the long journey to be over as the weary travellers. Distant city church bells tolled, not quite drowning out the shouts of vendors promoting the wares and the stamp of soldiers and horses coming and going to the far-flung parts of the empire, added to the distant din. Overhead, carrion birds and seagulls wheeled in the updrafts as the day heated up, and she breathed in the scent of the simple breakfast bread to go with the rough-cut tomatoes, adding basil hastily collected by the roadside.
Very smells.
Shall I do mine?
Yes,
please.
We promenaded the streets to marvel at the new architecture of our little town and see the tonic baths. Though the cobblestones were drying rapidly, we yet had to lift our skirts to protect the delicate muslin. The crescent she declared as magnificent as that of Bath, and she admitted that the Duke's new stables were indeed astonishing. Such arches, such Palladian magnificence, merely for horses. But she admired everything with the air of one who wishes to please her hostess by praising what she admires. Ever and anon, I saw her eyes straying wistfully to the wild encircling hills.
I was thinking,
from what she's reading,
It is very specific. If you know it.
Well, very good.
And the stables that were mentioned became a hospital, and that's where I was a nurse manager.
So I hope that you'll have a go at that exercise. We found it very useful. Mm-hmm. It's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Nicola and Keziah Frost to tell us what's on their bedside table. Nicola.
It's The First and Only by Peter Flannery, because we interviewed Peter recently, and I actually managed to buy his book that was not the one that we were talking about in the interview. But I'm really enjoying it. It's basically about the only psychic in the world and how he hires an SAS gentleman called Steve to look after him because he wants to go and hand himself in to be experimented on and poked and prodded. There's a villain called Lucifer, which I felt was a little bit of an obvious name, I must say, but he's actually not the devil. He's just a really terrifying character. And he is trying to get rid of all the psychics. I think that's what's happening. He's killing the psychics as they come along, because apparently the human race is evolving and we are throwing up more and more true psychics, but they're all being annihilated as fast as they arrive.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting premise for the book. It's really well written. He does the thing of writing horror scenes very quickly, but very much conjuring up the horror of being there. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying it enormously. It's The First and Only by Peter Flannery.
Okay, thanks very much. Let's hear from Keziah.
All right. Well, it turns out that my favorite books, when I gather all my books in the house, they tend to be somehow or other always British 1930s. And I found a book at the bookstore the other day, Mystery in White by J. Jefferson Farjon. And I read that he was a descendant of Thomas Jefferson. And I thought, at last, an American writer that I'm going to like. And of course, it turns out he's British also. So this is Mystery in White, a Christmas crime story by J. Jefferson Farjon, originally published in 1937, recently republished. And it's just what I like. Farjon, in this standalone mystery, delivers suspense and laughter all in one neat package. Love it. Farjon lived from 1883 to 1955, and in his lifetime, he published 80 novels, greatly admired in his day. Dorothy L. Sayers said, Jefferson Farjon is quite unsurpassed for creepy skill in mysterious adventures. So the plot, I'll just read a little bit from the back of the book here. On Christmas Eve, heavy snowfall brings a train to a halt near the village of Hammersby. Several passengers take shelter in a deserted country house where the fire has been lit and the table laid for tea, but no one is at home. Trapped together for Christmas, the passengers are seeking to unravel the secrets of the empty house when a murderer strikes in their midst. Oh, don't you just love it? That's what I've been reading. The characters include the chorus girl, the old boar, and various and sundry mismatched personalities that are thrown together in an isolated house in a blizzard. It's just lots of fun.
Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast, for this week. Next week, we're celebrating our birthday!
Hooray! Yay!
Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Goodbye!
Bye! Bye.